Reason Town's hosting and bandwidth is sponsored by TylerMcGinnis.com, the linear course-based approach to learning web technologies. Thank you to TylerMcGinnis.com. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome to another episode of Reason Town. We're finally back after a long hiatus.
Yeah, it's been busy.
Well, hopefully we've arranged things to record a little more regularly now. And I think most of the episodes we've been talking about, I think mostly they're just going to be Jared, you and I talking together. So we'll talk and everyone will listen in and we'll get interviews in here. Sometimes you have some interviews recorded, right?
Yeah. One will be released before this goes out and then another one after.
Okay, so let's get started. First thing I wanted to do was talk about ReasonConf because I didn't get to go, even though I really wanted to go. But ReasonConf in Vienna just happened recently. You went, you presented, you led a workshop, and you did, like, you represented ReasonTown. So in a really short number of minutes, how was it?
It was fantastic. It was really well put on, especially for people that had never done a conference before, right? And so the first day was all workshops, and there were two parts to it. The morning was just kind of getting everybody set up, making sure everybody was familiar with the Reason syntax and all that. And then the afternoon was different advanced workshops, one on reprocessing, where I led that one, and participants built a game, a simple Pong game in Reason. And then there was a session on GraphQL and Reason React and awesome. Making a GraphQL client. And then another one on making a networked multiplayer game.
Oh, that's way cool.
With a Reason server in Node.js.
And those were all interactive, so none of those were recorded. They're not going to be released, right?
Right. Unfortunately, we didn't have recording equipment for it.
Okay. The talks might be.
The talks were all recorded, and the first couple have already been released. So look for that in the ReasonConf Twitter account. They've tweeted that out, and we can put links to them in the show notes.
And YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, they're hosted on YouTube. The selection of talks was incredible. Lots of really interesting things about things people are doing with Reason, things that they want to do with Reason. There was a really good talk about ways that Reason sometimes lets you down.
Interesting.
The little paper cuts that you come across while using Reason that is really good motivation for Cheng and the team to clean some things up. And a fascinating talk by Cristiano, who's at Facebook on the Reason team, about Reason animation. Just a ton of fun things.
That's great. I can't wait to watch those. And I think that's actually really interesting that they would throw in a talk about the hairy parts, the hard parts. That's cool.
Yeah.
It shows a lot of confidence in wanting to make it a cool tool and not just getting hype, you know, around
yeah.
it. So that's sweet.
Yeah. And I also loved the conference was about 150 attendees.
Okay.
So it was nice and small, and you could, by the end of the 3 days, I pretty much could recognize everybody.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so there was a lot of talking to each other and a really close feel.
And from the photos, the venue looked beautiful and comfortable. Was that the case too?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait for next year.
Mm-hmm. And there's some rumblings about a ReasonConf US.
Ooh.
So.
Do we know from whom? Or is that still quiet?
There are a couple of different options.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that would be sweet. I'll take a minute and plug. I'm helping to organize a conference called Framework Summit this fall in Park City, Utah, and Reason will be represented there as well. And the idea for that conference is that multiple framework vendors are going to come together to not to like have a throwdown, but to have a constructive place where someone can come to learn about the different options and pick what's right for their project. So the whole purpose of it is not to be kind of like come see the shootout and have all this debate. Like the point is to come kind of hear the different options and see what's going to work out best for you. So
cool.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes too. But if you want to come learn more about Reason and you don't know, then that might be a good place because the talks will be targeted toward teaching people who don't know a whole lot about it, why they would want to use it, I think.
Awesome. Have the talks been selected already?
Nope. CFP isn't open yet, I don't think.
Okay. Any Reason audience members that want to represent Reason?
Yes, please submit a talk. This is the first year, so we're running lean. Yeah. You're not going to like, you probably won't get gold plated teeth or anything as a speaker gift, you know, if you get picked, but, it will be an enjoyable and smaller conference, hopefully a similar kind of compact and, enlightening experience to the one you just had at recent Conf Europe. So
cool.
Framework Summit this year. That's a small plug for me.
All right.
Any other comments on recent Conf before we hit the next thing?
I don't think so. There was a... So the third day was a hackathon the whole day,
okay.
Where people took the knowledge and the ideas that they had from talks and from the workshops and put them into practice. And there were some really cool projects that came out of that. We'll talk about one of those in our plug section at the end.
Okay, super cool. That we're going to have a recording soon, too, with the organizers of the conference. And so stay tuned for that one because I'm interested to talk about like what went well in the conference and maybe ideas for those who are trying to do their own conferences and stuff. But without further ado, let's talk really quickly about the new BuckleScript stuff because there have been a few new releases recently, specifically BuckleScript 3.0 and 3.1 and 3.14. So big stuff I noticed in 3.0, the main thing is they removed js.boolean. So now the reason Boolean compiles to the JavaScript Boolean, they're one and the same. So you might see that if you're upgrading. Most libraries have already taken care of that. I just said library, like Toy Story. Most libraries have already taken care of that in their code.
Yeah. And that was a really nice thing for debugging and for JavaScript interop. It's no longer one and zero. Like, what is this weird number doing in my code?
Definitely. Big improvement there, I think. For just programmability. I keep saying usability, but it's like for the programmer that matters. Along those lines are printing records in the new BuckleScript 3.1, right?
Yeah.
So for debuggability, now if you log out a record before what you saw was an array of values, because that's what they would compile to under the hood, but it looks like for debugging purposes, now you get back out an actual record from the debugger.
That's right. If you compile with a debug flag, you can enable... custom printers in the Chrome debugger.
Cool.
And so records and variants and lists.
Oh wow.
And all this stuff is now annotated behind the scenes such that it can display the original record property names. It's so much nicer.
That's huge. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I've got to start taking advantage of that. So in order to do that, you do have to throw in a compiler flag.
Yeah.
Okay. Good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Fast piping. Let's talk about that for a second, because I don't know that that's super documented.
But yeah.
You got like your normal pipe is the bar with the right arrow with the greater than, and that looks like a pizza kind of. So that's like right pizza is what the Elm people call it.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I like it.
You have right pizza and left pizza.
Okay,
but you don't have left pizza by default in Reason.
Right.
But you do now. You have the right pizza, and then you also have the bar dot. That's a fast pipe.
Is that a golf club maybe?
Yeah, it looks like a golf club or the Patreon logo or something. Yeah.
Right.
And so what that, the difference is that the pizza right takes whatever argument is coming in on the left side of the operator and it sticks it as the last parameter to whatever function you are placing on the right side of the pizza right, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So if you have person pizza add name, then the function on the right of the pizza gets the person as the last argument.
Yep, from the left. Now the fast pipe with the pipe dot is a little different because it takes the argument on the left and it sticks it as the first parameter to the function. So that it's a slight difference, but it makes it's a significant usability change. It's cool that we have both of them.
Yeah.
And most of the functional world that I've been aware of up to this point from Haskell and Elm, etc., follows the convention of the piping where the argument goes at the end.
Right.
But Elixir, which I've also used, does it at the beginning. I talked to Chang on Discord about it, and he had a few reasons why putting it at the beginning actually can make a bit more sense and complicate things quite a bit less.
Yeah.
And I've used both ways and I really feel like it's fine. So I'm glad we have both operators. So
yeah, the fruits of the fast pipe won't really come to bear until we have IDE support for coming up with functions that can operate on the object to the left of it.
Yeah.
where with the normal pipe operator, you can't really know what function to suggest, because it's like anything that has this object as the last argument or the nth argument.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
And so there's really not much point in trying to come up with useful arguments to use, functions to use for this object. But with the fast pipe, you can almost get like an object-oriented feel where it's like, oh, you know, I'm using this object that's from this module, and this module also exports a dozen functions that take that record type as the first argument. So I can just, you know, I can autocomplete those.
Yeah.
And it's a much smoother experience.
So saying like you have a module person, you have a person.t type, which is a record, and then you have a function called name, like get name, that takes the person t type as its first argument and then returns a string. In that case, the IDE could say, if you have a person variable that's of type t, you could do fast pipe, and then it could say, oh, here are all the things you can fast pipe on.
Exactly.
From the module. That's super cool.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that. That's great.
Yeah. So in my mind, that's the major win. Now we don't have that yet in our IDEs, but hopefully that'll be coming.
Should we hint about the stuff you've been working on or keep that secret?
Oh, we can talk about it. I've been loud about it on Discord.
Okay.
I had the crazy idea coming back from ReasonConf, like, what if I built a new language server for Reason? Because the current one uses Merlin, which has been around for a long time and has been used for OCaml to give you IDE-like features. But Merlin has not a very good history of Windows support, and it can it's fairly large. Lots of dependencies can be hard to set up if you want to hack on it yourself. And so I just thought, how far can I get with just the BuckleScript compiler and the artifacts that it generates, and building a pure Reason language server? And I got really far. I'm hoping to release a beta of it soon for people to try out.
And no native or anything, right? No BSB native necessary, or is that required?
So it is compiled with BSB native.
Okay.
But it interacts with the normal BuckleScript compiler.
Okay, cool.
So that means that it's fast. You know, it compiles down to a native binary for your Mac or Linux or Windows. And it works on normal BuckleScript projects.
That's
for
interesting.
Sure.
Okay, so this isn't like if compiled JavaScript where you're getting the cost of evaluating JavaScript at runtime,
right,
running on V8. Like you compile it to a binary.
Yeah.
Before shipping it out. That's pretty sweet. And that, really quickly, I'd like to know, how do you handle multiple platform compilation and distribution on NPM? Because that always seems like a nightmare.
Right. And there are a couple of different ways that people do it. What I'm hoping to do, if this all works out and if I have a really solid product, is to ship it with BuckleScript.
Okay.
So when you install BS Platform, it also has the IDE support binary in there.
Oh, that would be awesome.
And so when you open VS Code or Eclipse or anything, it knows, oh, just it's in Node modules along with BSB. That's the language server to talk to.
That'd be way cool.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
And then it also gets around the problem of, oh, what if your language server version is different from the OCaml version that you're using, or like there are a bunch of weird distribution problems that are solved if you just ship it with the compiler.
And you get refumped in there too.
Yeah.
Which is, refumps amazing.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's see. That is awesome. Fastpipe makes a lot of sense. And okay, I want to talk really quickly about deriving abstract.
Oh yeah.
And about object types. So there are multiple ways. We'll do a whole episode on this probably at some point, but there are coming to mind immediately three ways to represent JavaScript objects. No, there are many more than that, but at least three obvious ways to represent JavaScript objects in Reason are js.object, or in other words, js.t, right?
Mm-hmm.
js.t, actual JSON, js.json, and there's actually js.dict as well, so this is going to be more than three.
Right.
And there's the Reason record that uses deriving abstract. So we won't go over all those right now, but I'm going to compare JS.T to deriving abstract and why you would maybe want to use one or the other, because I've used both a lot recently, just in the last week or two, and found pain and pleasure with both. But the JS.T, basically, the interesting thing about this, now, I don't know about this anywhere else in the language, so I'd be really curious to know, but essentially, when you start to use a JS object, JS.T object, you're opting into structural typing instead of nominal typing. You end up meaning that no longer are you saying, like, oh, well, I have a person type here, and this function takes a person type. All of a sudden, you're saying, I have an object of this shape. So the type system actually understands you saying, I have a special record with these fields on it. And so it starts to understand. You can do some pretty awesome things, because what you can say actually is you can say, like, this function, instead of expecting a person, expects an object with, or a record with at least these fields, like a JavaScript record with at least these fields and no more, or those fields only. So it turns it into you working with types based on the structure that they have. And as you transform their structure, like, you could get in an object with three fields and then augment it, add three more fields and return it. And now your type is changed on the way out. So I don't know if that explained that very well.
And this is how all of Flow works. If you've used Flow type in JavaScript, all object definitions are based on the shape. So if you have two type declarations that are the same shape but have different names, Flow treats them as exactly the same type. Whereas in Reason, if you have two record declarations and they have different names, or even if they have the same name,
it kicks them out.
Yeah. And they can't be interchanged.
But I do want to know more about that, because I started to dig into this and realize that, like, the Reason syntax of wrapping quotes around the keys, that sugar syntax, is actually just a way of saying, like, it's a JavaScript object that wraps a Reason record in the type space. So you say, like, JS.T of record with a dot. That's a Bucklescript thing, right?
So it is not a record. It's an object. Where OCaml stands for objective camel, it has an object oriented system in it that has this what is called row polymorphism. That's what we were describing, structural typing. And so there's a way to make objects that aren't JavaScript related. It's more cumbersome. The syntax and kind of the language design really privileges records, because they're easier to type check and they're faster and they have some nice properties.
But they're all nominally typed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the object system is structurally typed. And so that is what you're producing when you use the quotes syntax. It is an object.
Makes a lot of sense. That's really interesting. So the reason that I was having to switch back and forth between these and kind of experience the differences between them. We haven't talked at all about deriving abstract. What deriving abstract does is you make a record type, an actual OCaml record type, which is nominally typed. You add the directive to it, Bucklescript bs.deriving abstract. And what that will do is that will then represent that record as a JavaScript object as its implementation underneath. So if you are worried about wrapping your JavaScript code because you're doing a lot of interop, instead of using JS.T, you could say, oh, this type that's coming in conforms to this record that uses deriving abstract. It also generates a bunch of accessors and setters for those fields. And here's where it starts to get a little bit interesting, is like those accessors, and setters that it generates are named as the fields are named. Right. And that's module wide. So yeah. If you have a record that's like person and a person, or I'm sorry, a record that's, this is hard to pull out of the top of my head, but like, let's say you have a record that's person and a record that's dog, right? And you define them all in the same module space, and you say that they're both deriving abstract, and you give them both the attributes of name. Like, a person can have a name and a dog can have a name. Those setters and getters that are generated will only apply to whichever type was listed later in the file. They'll clash.
Right, because you can have, you can override a function later and that function gets generated. Although that That issue would also apply if you just used records, because record attribute names are similarly scoped.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. But you can access a record attribute on itself, right? So you could, if you didn't use driving abstract, you could have a person and a dog with names defined in the same file, and you could say, like, you know, if you had person A, you could say person A.name, and it would know to look on the person.
Only object. If it knew beforehand that that was a person type and not a dog type.
Right.
So it gets a little complicated with the way the inference works.
Okay.
And so generally, the way I do it is just not have, not reuse attribute names if I'm in the same module. And okay. If I have multiple record types in the same module, I'll often make a submodule for each one.
Yeah.
So that all the attribute names are scoped.
Hence you have person.t and dog.t. So that was cool, but this is actually going to start transitioning into the main topic of this episode, which is GraphQL. But the reason this became interesting was because we're taking on a big new project at work right now, and I'm writing a server that uses GraphQL API on the front end and then uses a service called Prisma on the back end, which is super cool. We'll talk about that in a second too. But I was using a project that would take my GraphQL definition, and I was then generating type definitions in Reason that code so that I could use the objects that were coming in without having to do a whole lot of JSON decoding and encoding. Because I said, okay, well, the GraphQL layer automatically verifies that the object is the correct structure for me. So it's safe to just assume that as long as I've generated my types from the GraphQL definition, I'm safe. I don't have to worry about encoding or decoding. So I was originally doing it as JavaScript, JS.t objects, doing the structural typing, and that was working out fine. There were some complexities in that, like, my GraphQL type had dependencies in between the types. So maybe...
Sure.
Like, for example, like a journal and an entry... an entry would depend on a journal, and maybe a journal would have a list of entries. So you might have mutually recursive types. Mm-hmm. So that gets into the space where if you're defining the type, you have to do like an and. You have to join your types with an and you have to mark it as recursive as well. So there was some interesting stuff there.
Yeah.
But it worked well enough. And then the new Buckle script came out, and they said, hey, JS.t is deprecated. Use deriving abstract. So I changed the template code. I regenerated all the types. And it got nasty because I had to now generate modules for every one of the types in the GraphQL definition.
And recursive modules are a little more exciting to deal with.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts, because once you have modules joined together using that and keyword, you also have to generate a module type, module signature.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just, like, the code started to get hairy.
And
the code, like the accessor code, was getting complex as well, because you have to use, like, let's say I had a person object. Instead of saying person # name, which is kind of nice and concise, I was doing open the person module, pass in the person value, fast pipe it to the name function. So
it
got a little hairy too.
Yeah.
So we actually ended up moving back to js.t, which... it may become undeprecated. I'm not sure at this point what the future holds, but
yeah, I think it's still definitely a use case that will be supported. There's the BS deriving abstract is an interesting new exploration. I don't think it's been I don't think all the kinks have been worked out as much. Where it's like, oh, how do we deal with having a bunch of different things that we're generating, that kind of thing. It's really nice to have it generate an object in the back end. But yeah, I use js.t for some things as well.
So that's where it comes into, like, which one should I use? The question kind of depends on what you're trying to do with it. In this case, for me, in my code where I was taking values from my front-end GraphQL layer and moving them to this next GraphQL layer, and mostly I had to, like, take these values and just transform them a little bit, I want to spend some time to get it to a better place, because right now it feels like mostly what I'm doing is dropping down into js.raw. And, or I'm sorry, bs.raw. And because what I'm doing is dynamic stuff. Like this, I don't feel very type safe because it's not. I'm taking in values and I'm saying like, well, when the value comes in, if it has this attribute on it, go ahead and delete that attribute and replace it with this other thing. Like I'm really transforming the value and sending it on, forwarding the request onto the back end, which is by nature dynamic. So I have some thoughts to work out here.
Yeah.
And, but maybe we should clear this up, pause for a second, and introduce GraphQL really quickly.
Right. Yeah.
For those who, I don't know if you've been under a rock and haven't heard about GraphQL at all, but why don't you give us a quick introduction?
Sure. So GraphQL is, it's a way to define a schema for your server. And then on the client, you query for specific fields on specific objects such that you don't have to define a new REST endpoint for a bunch of different things. If you're familiar with SOAP back in the day or Swagger, there have been a bunch of different ways to like have a standard format to define your API, and this is the latest one. Facebook has been using using GraphQL for several years, and they recently open sourced it, and lots of people have been getting excited about it. And there are a lot of really nice tools that you get access to.
Amazing. It's amazing.
And automatic documentation of your APIs. And there's a great tool that you get for free when you're using GraphQL that allows you to just explore what different queries will look like. And that is fantastic if you're coming from, you know, a traditional REST background where it's like shot in the dark, I wonder what this does.
It speeds up development insanely and comprehension as well. It's amazing. And to be clear about like the nuts and bolts of how this works so it doesn't sound magic, basically it's still working over HTTP, but you can use other transport layers. So like if you wanted to on your server, you could implement GraphQL on top of protobufs. Basically, it's just a pattern and a set of libraries. It's a standard, right?
Yeah.
But the general implementation is I generate a string body, which has the GraphQL query language in the string inside of it, which is kind of like JSON-ish, but it's definitely not JSON. And I send it in a post request with, and my client knows, or I'm sorry, my server knows that it's expecting GraphQL.
Yeah.
And then the server takes that, it parses it, it also validates it, which is great. So if you send in an inappropriate request, well, first of all, your client might stop you from that because the tooling is cool. So you might actually get helped from not sending bad requests initially anyway because your tooling stops you. But once you send it in, the server will actually do validation for free and say, no, I'm sorry, that's not an accurate attribute that you're asking for.
Yeah.
And so once you're running your GraphQL server, you know that the data that's coming into you meets the expectations that you've set by typing your schema, which is super cool. And plus, it keeps you honest too, because if you try to return a value that's invalid, that doesn't fit into the schema, or if you don't return what's expected, then the server also will throw an error response, and you know you should not do that. But at least you'll see it in your log. So that'd be a runtime thing. But
that's right.
That's way cool.
And basically, the client that you send the query that you send in from the client is the shape of the data that you want.
Yes.
And at Khan Academy, we've been using GraphQL. But now let's talk about GraphQL on the client, because this is something that really excites me. Where there is a community project called Reason Apollo. And if you've done anything with GraphQL, you've probably heard of Apollo. They are one of the biggest names in GraphQL right now. And they have a really cool front-end library for managing your GraphQL and doing all of the fancy stuff that we haven't even talked about, like deduplicating of queries and smart caching and all this stuff. That kind of goes beyond just the core GraphQL specification. But they have this nice client library that has good bindings to React. And someone in the Reason community was like, we've got Reason React. I want Apollo to work with this. And so they have it set up, and it's so nice. I talked about this in my talk at ReasonConf, but you write your query in your Reason React app, and it will, at compile time, make sure that your query is valid.
So cool.
And it will give you IDE autocomplete when you're dealing with the data that comes out. It blows my mind.
Mind-blowingly cool.
Yeah. So that is the dream of working with, you know, we already have a typed definition for this data. Just bring it all the way to the client so that I won't ever ship a client that will get those validation errors when I send into query.
And it makes it feel like you're not really necessarily having client server anymore either. It's like you're just using data, right?
Yeah.
In your IDE, which is, I think that was maybe the dream of XML, RPC, or, you know, like remote protocol objects back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe we got to be careful with that because we're not mindful of the cost of remote data. But there's some incredible stuff going on there. So tell us a little bit about, you probably understand more than I do, about how the PPX works. And maybe just give everyone an idea of what PPXs are in general.
Yeah, so a PPX is stands for maybe preprocessor extension.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
But basically, it's a code transform. If you've used JavaScript in Babel, it's a Babel plugin that will take the syntax tree. So after your code has been parsed, it is in a tree of if statements and expressions and all these things.
So it's a big data structure, right?
And it will transform that into a new one, and it can do code generation. It can do validation. Run tests. It can do these plugins can do all kinds of things. In this case, the GraphQL PPX is taking the query that you wrote as a GraphQL query, parsing it, and then validating it against your server's schema.
So you actually write a string, you write a multi-line string, and you give it a GraphQL tag as the PPX directive.
Yeah.
And that gets validated.
That's right.
Which is super cool.
And this is the same string that you would write if you were using Apollo in React. It's the same query that you would write if you were using the graphical IDE-like interface to GraphQL. So you just drop it in, and then it will create a type signature for it so that you get all the autocomplete and stuff like that. And do the validation on it.
Well, that's just it. It's not even, this is what I didn't understand really before I started using it. It's not just autocomplete. Like I thought, it'll be autocomplete on the fields as I'm building the query. I didn't get that. I don't think it does do that. What it does do is it actually dynamically, it at compile time gives you a structural type of the response of the data based on the fields you're querying.
Yeah.
So if I say like, I'm going to go ahead and query all my journals and I'm going to just get the name and the color of each journal, it's going to return you an array, well, based on the type, right, of the API you're querying. But basically it would say like, what I'm giving you back is an array of JS objects that have the attribute name and color.
Yeah.
And it type checks on it. So
exactly.
No longer you're like, I'm just getting back JSON and then I gotta parse it and make sure it's valid. It's super cool.
And again, the reason type system helps you even more because what you get back is a sum type that could be a response, it could be loading, or it could be failed. And you have to do a switch to handle each of the cases.
Oh, yes.
So you can't write code that doesn't handle the failure case.
Very cool. So such helpful tools. This is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So GraphQL and Reason Apollo on the front end, I think, is super promising.
I'm going to throw in one more thing that I forgot to make perfectly clear, just as if you're starting to dive into GraphQL. But the brain change about you're not fetching complete objects anymore. I already said this where I was saying it, like it's not fetching a list of journals, but because I was trying to do this typing in my mind where I was like, okay, if I'm going to authorize a person, I have to fetch their journal first and then get this attribute off the journal and then maybe do this other fetch. But once I started to use the GraphQL PPX and build the query, I was like, actually, all I need is the ID from the journal. And in fact, what I need is like the ID from the user who owns the journal. And so I'll just write this one query and I won't fetch the list of journals. I'm just going to get the one, like I'm going to select the field ID that I need. And I get back this tiny piece of data that's specifically for the one thing I need. And it's fast and non-complex. And I don't have to like get types back and parse them into objects and then get the attributes on them. And I love it. I think it's amazing.
And this, this gets back to the name GraphQL, Graph Query Language. And it's saying your data isn't just a bunch of tables. These tables have references to each other. And so there's a graph of data, and you can traverse that graph very easily to drill in and just get the data you need.
So look to the future, everybody. It's coming.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we've covered GraphQL pretty well. If you have questions or comments about the stuff we've said today, we want to hear them. Oh, that was a smooth transition to the next part.
Yeah.
Now, so smooth. Now it's not smooth. But we were trying to figure out a good place to have community interaction. And we're glad to receive tweets or emails to direct contact. But maybe a great place to put questions or comments would be on reasonml.chat, which is a discourse instance for Reason. Go ahead and you could sign in with your GitHub profile. Which is now your Microsoft profile.
Oh, gosh.
I'm kidding. I'm a fan of the acquisition.
Right.
In any case, I digress. But go ahead and sign in. Go to reasonml.chat and create a new topic. And we've asked for the tag to be created, ReasonTown. We don't know if it will be. I'm assuming they're going to be nice to us and create it.
Yeah. But
go ahead, look for that tag and go ahead and leave us feedback or ask questions or solve our problems. That'd be great too. Jared doesn't have any problems, but I do. so that'd be great. And we got a little pick to pick as well.
That's right. Here at the end, I love to watch the Look What I Built channel on Discord. Lots of people posting in there about fun things they make. And the thing I'm going to talk about today is something that was actually built during the ReasonConf hackathon.
So cool.
And it is a PPX. So it is a compiler plugin that will extract your internationalizable strings. And so you are going through your front end with a Reason React app, and you've got various user-facing strings that you want to be able to translate. And there are Babel plugins that do this for JavaScript, and now there's one for Reason that will extract it, output a nice JSON file that you can upload to your translation service, and then it will integrate it as well.
So in other words, it'll give you some kind of thing where you change the file, put it back in, switch the language, and it'll swap out the strings for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the sound of my mind being blown right there. That's incredibly cool.
Yeah.
So picking that, we'll put the link in there, link for the PPX.
Yeah, I think it's called React Intel
Extractor. So was there that all done in one day?
The creator had started it, I think, before, and then jamming with some other people got it to the finish line.
That's way cool.
Yeah.
So I've looked a little bit into creating PPXs. It looks like you have to be pretty comfortable with OCaml native stuff because it's all native, right?
Right.
You don't just like drop in a Reason file and write a PPX like you would with Babel and JavaScript, right?
Right. It's not nearly that streamlined. And part of the reason for that is they're very powerful and very complicated, and it's not a very there's not a really good user experience around it yet. And so for most things, like if you've used a language with macros, it can get kind of hairy and really like hard for outsiders to come in and understand what's going on because they're doing so many transformations on the source before it actually gets run. So the general idea is tread lightly. I've been dreaming up some tools to make it easier to write them.
Do you think that's a good idea, or do you think it should remain hard to write them? Because if it's hard to write them, then fewer people will write dumb stuff.
Yeah.
But maybe also fewer people will write good stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. So it's a hard line to walk.
How often, in your personal opinion, should PPXs be reached for versus just trying to keep to core?
Much more often try and do it normally. Right. Yeah. Just try and write the code. If there's a little boilerplate, just write it.
Reduce complexity.
There are definitely cases where this would be ridiculous to do by hand. Like, for example, extracting all the translatable strings.
Yeah.
That's not something that, it really relieves the maintenance burden to have something that goes through and does that automatically. And if a PPX is done well, then it won't be too much magic.
Won't obfuscate the intent too much.
Right. But again, it's a hard line to tread. I think as a community, we have a down-to-earth philosophy enough that it probably won't get out of hand. But we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see if that maintains as the community scales too.
Yeah.
One other PPX that I don't have a link for, but I have heard through the grapevine of, which sounds incredibly cool too, is one that lets you write CSS for inline attributes as a string, and it actually type checks your CSS for you as well.
Ooh.
Make sure that you're writing valid values and also valid names for your CSS attributes, which is pretty sweet. And then I think it'll actually turn those into style strings to put on your React
nice
things. So I'm not going to link that because I haven't used it personally, but heard it through the grapevine. Sounds super cool.
Right. Another example of what you could do.
Yeah. The power of, I think that could be a big win where PPXs are actually doing extra type checking for you.
Yeah.
Doing type safety and not just saving you, a few lines of code kind of thing. Well, I think we did that. All of it.
Yeah. I think that's all we got.
Thanks everybody. Until next time.
Bye.
Just kidding, we're back. Welcome to the after show, because there was a big chunk of this show where we went way off into the weeds, probably more than what most people want to hear. So we cut that chunk out, we moved it to the end, and that's what you're going to hear now. So there was the original show, and now this is the details.
So if you're really interested in GraphQL type systems and how a GraphQL middleware server could be written in Reason, then keep listening. We don't come up with any conclusions, but there are some really interesting questions.
And there won't be a good ending either. The audio will just cut off because that was where we ended it. So just listen till the end and enjoy and let us know.
All right.
Yep. Thanks. Bye. So that prevents what's called overfetching, right? Where you're not getting more data than you actually need and wasting sending that over the wire, et cetera. I was going ahead and working with GraphQL and implementing a server that used Postgres on the back end. And once I started to get into object joins, which are part of GraphQL too, which is super cool. So like I'm used to saying like, okay, well, I'll return you a list of journals and each of them will have a user ID on them. Or maybe like I'll return you. So in order to like get a user's journals, you would fetch the user first and then say, oh, now I've got the user ID. I'll go and ask for a list of journals. Like that would be the traditional REST way of doing it.
Yeah.
But what you do with GraphQL is you just say, oh, well, on each journal object, I'll add a reference back to the user that owns it. And on the user, I'll just have a list of journals that belong to it. And so the query itself, when it comes in, then the server is responsible for looking and saying, oh, okay, so I'm fetching the user and the person wants their journals. So I'll go and make all the correct fetches from the database, put that data together, and ship it back.
Yeah.
Which is super cool, and it starts to get a little bit complex once you're implementing it on the back end.
That's true. But it can cut down on the number of requests that you have to make. And also, if you don't need the user's journals, then the backend doesn't have to make that extra database call.
Yes.
So it can produce a reasonably minimal query as well.
Which is way cool. But here's where, once it started to get a little bit hairy, I was looking around the internets, and there's a company that is really pushing and supporting GraphQL called Prisma. They've written a pretty awesome server that stands in front of common databases. Their goal is every database ever. Right now they do MySQL and Postgres, but their deal is basically like exposing your database as a GraphQL API in its entirety. And it's open source. The technology is open source. You can run it. You can just get it and run it for free with no cost. Or you can use their cloud offering and stuff. But we started experimenting with it, and our minds were immediately blown. This was so cool. You basically just take your types. You structure your types how you want to store them and access them in the database. And you give them a GraphQL file of just your types. No special queries or anything. You just say, here are my types. I'm working a lot with journals and entries because I work at day one. So let's say here are journals, entries, and attachments and stuff. And then I publish an API, And it goes and it automatically takes care of database migration. It creates all of the tables, all of the rows, and all of the indices for optimized querying, and generates all of the code on the back end for actually storing and fetching all of those resources, including pagination, sorting, like all of the stuff you would expect from complex querying. Oh, there's my clock. It's evening time. Now you feel like you're in your grandfather's house. And so I thought that was cool until I started to really dig into it and realize how really comprehensive the API that they generate is. Because I can say, at any point, I could say, like, okay, well, I'm making a user and I want to create a journal as well. Well, they have fields for that because you send up a create user mutation. It's got a special type specifically for creating a user with the required fields. And you can add in, like, oh, and also make a journal at the same time and attach it to the user.
Wow.
Or you could say, like, oh, create a journal and also attach it to an existing user, because they have fields. They've generated types and fields for all of these different circumstances where you would want to associate or relate data together.
Okay.
So here's what's way cool is this got, like, this is GraphQL stuff just was mind-blowingly simplifying for us on the authorization end. Or is that the right? I always get confused between authorization and authentication. Yes, authorization. So, like, let's say in day one we've got a circumstance where in the future we would love for people to be able to share journals. And so, and maybe when you share a journal with someone, you can give them read-only access or write-only access or like partial access. So what we've done in the data structure is say, all right, so there are the journals that belong to you. Then there are the journals that have been shared with you. And inside those journals, you may have authored posts that the original owner of the journal hasn't. So there's this kind of complex relationship that happens there. So when we're doing the authorization for modifying an entry, it doesn't become just a normal, like, oh, does this person own this journal and entry? But it becomes the GraphQL. We were able to do this all in one GraphQL query, which is amazing. I say, something's coming in, and I say, okay, well, fetch the entry they're trying to modify and include the journal that it belongs to and the person who owns that journal, and include the people with whom that journal is shared, and include the owner or the creator of that entry and the share permissions. Like I just said, that graph, which is stored across many different tables and would have taken me multiple requests and gluing and cutting to try to put together myself. So I said, just give me, and I said, also only give me the fields that I care about, which are like the specific permissions, the IDs, and the IDs of these things.
Yeah.
They came back all in one query. I had the fields immediately accessible that I needed, and authorization was done. And I was like, I am sold. This is so cool. So so we started building on that. And this is where Reason started to become a little, the strictness of Reason started to become a little more complex for me, because I now have a GraphQL query on the front end where people are sending GraphQL queries and mutations to my server, which I'll be running in Lambda or wherever, it doesn't matter. And I'll be taking those queries, authenticating the person, authorizing the request, and doing a little bit of extra stuff. So the Prisma API on the back end is just raw database stuff. I'm not going to expose that to the general world, because I want to do things like, say, you are only, like, when you try to create a journal or an entry, I'm automatically assigning it to you so that you can't, like, sneak in and create a journal and assign someone else's ID to it and,
sure,
you know, get sneaky information in there, right? So
okay, so Prisma won't do any of, like, validation beyond what the GraphQL schema can give you?
Correct, okay. Yeah. At least at this point. They may be working on something, but at this point, the counsel and guidance is, like, this is your database. Then write your application in front of it and use the database.
Gotcha.
So at this point, then I said, okay, well, I'm getting a query in to, like, make a journal. Now I need to, like, add the current authenticated user as the author of that journal and then forward the query on to the database with a little bit of modification.
Yeah.
And my mind had to change the way it thought about things, because I was doing the types for all this stuff. And I was like, okay, well, if you... let's say the person is asking for a list of journals. I was like, well, the return type from accessing the database is going to be a list of journals. That's not true anymore with GraphQL. It's going to be a list of fields.
That's right.
It's going to be a list of whatever the user requested from the front-end API.
Right.
So I was like, oh, I have to forward the requested fields along to the back end
Yeah.
So this becomes really dynamic for me.
Interesting. Because you're doing, it's essentially GraphQL middleware.
Yes.
Right? A query comes in and you have to do some validation, a little bit of manipulation, but you can't know beforehand what the exact shape is, because that's why we like GraphQL. Because you can request any shape that you want that fits the type.
Yeah, exactly right. So I feel like there is an answer here. Like the fields are defined ahead of time, so they can't just throw whatever they want in there. So right. Anything that's unspecified could be an option, you know, an optional kind of thing. So there are ways to type and represent that value as it's coming through and mutate it as well.
Yeah.
There aren't like super easy ways. I know that there are code generators. So Prisma will also generate, this is pretty neat too, they'll also generate library code bindings to Prisma so that you don't just have to send normal requests or GraphQL requests to them. You can actually basically generate an API for your language, but they've only implemented JavaScript and TypeScript. And I forked it to try to start to do Reason. And then I was like, wow, I'm shaving the yaks over
right.
here.
I gotta get getting some into the weeds.
But you can generate typed interfaces to their database API, which is cool. So at that point, and that's part of the question there, is like, if I were to fork it and implement the Prisma binding for Reason, would I use JS.T? Would I use records? Would I generate encoders and decoders?
Right.
Would I use abstracts? You know, that's kind of the question
there.
So that's why right now I'm opting for BS.raw and just doing it dynamically, which gets it done, but it's not ideal.
Yeah, it does feel like a case where row polymorphism, where structural types are what you want, where you will add to the query the user, even if they didn't want it, because you need to validate it. And so you know that what you get back has at least a user. But that sounds like a stretching experience.
Yeah, it's been an interesting growth experience for me. So I'm curious about that, because with the row polymorphism and the object types in OCaml, maybe I can dig into like real world OCaml and read some more about objects. But the APIs for JS.T, the library functions that are included with BuckleScript are empty, like empty JS object and assign, and that's it. I think there might have been one other. I don't remember what it was. But there's no way to remove a field from an object.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, like, is that something I could add? Like, right now the object.assign code says, like, take any shape of an object and any other shape of an object and then mush them together kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
Like, I want code that says, okay, now I want to take any shape of an object and, like, I want to... If we're talking about Boolean math, like I want not the union of them. I want
the difference. I think
the difference. Of them. Yeah, basically.
Because you added something to the query that you don't want to send back to the client.
That's what gets complex. Yes. So like I've made my API a little bit more simple, quite a bit more simple than the Prisma API, where I say like, okay, create an entry and just add the journal ID onto it. And that is in the field journal ID. And that is something that Prisma doesn't understand, because their query is structured where you actually attach a journal and you say like journal, and then there's a field that says like attach, and then you give it the ID. So that's super simple for me to transform. So when my query comes in, I say, okay, well, if there's a journal ID field on the query, on the mutation, go ahead and take that ID, pop it off, remove the field, and then I'll transform it into the Prisma way of doing it.
Oh, that's quite complex. So you want to swap out this object that's on one attribute and not return that, and instead give a different attribute with something that you got from there.
Yeah, well, because if I try to send an object to the Prisma backend with the attribute journal ID, I'll get a type error.
That's right.
Because journal ID doesn't exist. And I was like, well, I'll just set it to null or undefined. Setting it to undefined with object.assign doesn't actually change anything. Setting it to null is and undefined aren't equal. So
that's right.
Since there are actual nullable types in GraphQL, it says there's still not a field, you know, that I can set that's called journal ID, even
right.
though it's null.
Yeah, I think you'll have to create an external function that does that little bit, that is remove this field.
But is there a way to represent that in the type system? Like, is there a structural type function that does subtraction of fields rather than just the merging of fields? That's what I want to find out.
Yeah, I don't think there's that kind of algebra on types, unfortunately.
We've gotten way down in the weeds. I'm sorry if we've lost you listeners. But if you actually know the answer, I'd appreciate hearing.
Yeah. It could be that you can get, that you can jump around it with generation, code generation.
Okay.
Where based on, you know, you just add an attribute or something, some metadata to your code that is, you know, I want you to generate this type with subtracting something else out.
I'm thinking what the actual answer is going to be that's going to feel good is I'll generate code on both sides where I generate the type of their query coming in with nullable types. Sorry, I just hit the microphone and probably made a weird sound. You generate the type coming in with nullable fields, and then you also generate types for the Prisma API, and then you just treat every field and say, okay, well, for every field. Like, the only problem you end up with there is then you add another field to your API and you forget to add it, and the type system doesn't, like, you forget to forward it along.
Right.
The type system doesn't tell you. So that's where you'd have to catch it with tests or something. You know.
Well, if you're generating it from the GraphQL schema.
You could do that, but there's nothing that would require you to forward the field between the types. Does that make sense? If you have a type for the GraphQL API on the front end that you have, and then a type for the Prisma API, there's no check that's saying, make sure all the fields are forwarded from the front end API to the back end API.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's where you're like, oh, well, so my choice here between, like, do I do the dynamic thing and get runtime errors where I'm just like saying forward everything unless, oh, oops, some of the, you know, I added a field that I didn't mean to and now that can't be forwarded and I get a runtime error.
Right.
Or do I do the other thing where I forget to forward the field and then there's a bug that we don't get any logs about, but users have to say, like, hey, I saved this and now my, you know, my activity location isn't getting set on my entry or whatever. And it's like, oh, it's because I forgot to forward the field, you know?
Yeah.
So tests, I guess, could cover that.
Yeah. I think what I would want is a way to describe the transformation you're doing such that you can say everything other than this field that I'm transforming should be copied over.
Yeah. I wonder how you could do that.
But this does get quite a bit beyond what GraphQL supports at the type level, so it's very interesting.
I feel like at some point you have to be responsible as a programmer, and like the type system can't help you anymore, which is
sad. True. Yeah. Well, and this is a great example of where you had to get work done, and you were like, I need to be able to move on from this. I will drop in some JavaScript.
And it worked.
And I've really appreciated being able to do that, working with Reason, where it's like, this, I could pour another 5 hours into this and maybe not have a solution, or I could fix it now, ask on Discord, and come back to it.
Yeah, like I understand the risks of what are going on here, and it's acceptable for me at the moment. We can come back and fix it later.
Yeah.
So I'm happy with it right now, but I do want it to be better. So
yeah.
I think we'll get back to that. So there's a PPX for GraphQL.